Welcome to Cato's F.A. Hayek. Wait, we're not in the F.A. Hayek auditorium. I'm disoriented. Welcome to the Cato Institute. Thank you for coming, and thanks to those of you tuning in online. My name is Gene Healy. I'm Senior Vice President for Policy at Cato, and I'm going to do the introductions and a little light moderating for today's State Policy Leadership Forum. With a special focus on fiscal responsibility, tax policy, and educational freedom. We're very pleased to have with us today Governor Kim Reynolds of the great state of Iowa. She's Iowa's 43rd governor, serving that role since 2017, and the state's first female chief executive. Among Governor Reynolds' accomplishments in office, she's delivered the largest tax cuts in state history, including a reduction of the corporate tax rate from 12 to 9.8%, if I have that right, and an abolition of Iowa's inheritance tax. Under Governor Reynolds' reforms, Iowa's income tax structure will shift from a nine-bracket system with a top rate of almost 9% down to a single, simple 3.9% flat tax. For those efforts, among others, Governor Reynolds has earned the highest grade of A on the latest edition of the Cato Fiscal Policy Report Card on America's Governors. Governor Reynolds has been equally aggressive on the education policy front. Last month, she signed into law the Students First Act, under which education funding follows students and parents who enroll their children in an accredited private school will receive an amount equal to the per pupil funds allocated by the state to public school districts, roughly $7,500. That will be deposited into an education savings account to be used for tuition, fees, and other qualified educational expenses. The governor's co-panelists today are uniquely well-suited to further explore these issues in conversation with her. Chris Edwards in the center there holds the Kiltz Family Chair in Fiscal Studies at the Cato Institute, and he's co-author with Alana Blumsack of the aforementioned governor's report card. Now, Chris has sometimes been accused of grading on a curve, but he gave a lot of Fs this year. So it's not like everyone gets a smiley face sticker, and as he can tell you, every time a new edition of the report card comes out, he has to spend some time holding the phone away from his ear as various governors' chiefs of staff call to scream at him over their boss's lousy grades. Chris is also the editor of downsizinggovernment.org, your comprehensive online guide to shrinking the beast. And he hails from the great state of Canada. Our final panelist, Neil McCluskey, is, like myself, New Jersey-born and bred. Our home state's governor, Phil Murphy, got an F. Neil is the director of Cato's Center for Educational Freedom and the author of The Fractured Schoolhouse. A continuing theme of his work is that our one-size-fits-all public schooling system tends to feed culture war conflict, and that having funding follow students, as in, say, the Students First Act, can go a long way towards diffusing those sorts of conflicts. I should mention that we will have a conversation on these issues. We will later be taking questions, both from the in-person and online audience, and if you're out there in Twitter land talking about this event, you should use the hashtag GovReportCard. And with that, I'm going to get out of the way and hand it over to Chris to kick off today's discussion.
Great. Thanks a lot, Gene. Welcome to Cato. Governor Reynolds, delighted you're here. I'm just going to provide like a minute or so of additional background, then we can get into the discussion. I became aware of the governor's achievements back when I did the 2020 governor's report card. In that report card, she got the second highest grade, second only to Governor Sununu of New Hampshire. And then in 2022, she continued on with her tax reforms, and she got the highest grade. In my view, Governor Reynolds has been the most impressive, put in place the most impressive set of tax reforms in recent years than any state in the nation. She's also held the line on spending. She put into place occupational licensing reforms. She has initiatives this year to reform regulations in Iowa, to restructure Iowa government, to reduce the number of agencies, as well as some school choice reforms, which Neil will be talking about with the governor. So on the tax reforms, as Gene mentioned, the governor started her tax reform drive in 2018 with cuts to the top income tax rate and corporate tax rate. And as Gene mentioned, the top individual rate when all these reforms are put into place will drop from 8.9% down to just a 3.9% flat tax. And then on the corporate side, the rate dropped all the way from 12% to 5.5%. Really impressive reforms. So what motivated you or inspired you to do this series of reforms?
Well, the great thing about Republican governors is we're very competitive. And so Chris has really challenged me to let me know that he's coming after that number one spot next year, which means I'm going to have to continue to cut taxes for Iowans that I have the amazing opportunity to represent. But it's not just cutting taxes. And I think we've had some states that have had some difficulties with that. They cut taxes, but they didn't keep spending in check and therefore ran into some issues down the line. So not only did we want to be competitive, but I also wanted to make sure that I could make investments in priorities that were important to Iowans, and that meant being able to fund education, public safety. We put resources into broadband and housing and childcare. But overall, we knew if we were going to grow our economy and get people to stay in our state and attract people to the state, we needed to be more competitive. So it's actually been a lot of fun. I want to tell you, I'm excited about the results. It's challenging, but I've actually signed 3 tax cuts since taking office in 2017, so I'm really proud of the continued progression that we've made. And I can tell you without hesitation, we're not done. My goal is to get to zero individual income tax rate by the end of this second term. So we're really focused on that. We would have probably taken a look at it this year, bringing it down just a little bit more. But I wanted to kind of just watch what was happening with the environment, with inflation and recession. We always do a 2-year, 5-year budget. We did recession, non-recession, projected growth that we always base our budgets on. And we would have, I think, been okay. But, you know, I just focused on education reform this year and then really taking a look at government and how we provide services to Iowans. So I'm going to run through the statistics one more time because I'm really proud of them. When I took office, our top rate was almost 8.98%. We had 9 brackets. And as you heard, we'll go down to a flat tax, 3.9%, and we'll continue to take that down. Our corporate tax rate was one of the highest in the country, I think second, if not first, at nearly 12%. And the goal is 5.5%, and we took a big drop last year at 8.4, which we weren't projected to reach until 2026, and we were able to do that in the first year. So I'm very excited about the acceleration that we're seeing with that. And one of the other things that we did that, as I travel the state, we have an elderly population. Now, I see a lot of young people in the audience, so we're working really hard to change that. So take a look at Iowa. I think you'll be surprised at what you see. But we were taxing retirement income, and I was so tired of losing that valuable asset, which it is a valuable asset, to Florida and Arizona and some of those warm states. We do have a couple of months in January, December, where it's relatively chilly in Iowa. And I said to Ron, and I've said to Doug when Doug was the governor of Arizona, I don't care if they come down for a couple of our cold months in January and December, but I am not going to lose any more residents to your state. So we starting this year, we no longer tax retirement income. And I can tell you, I got a call from my father who can tell me how much more that means in his paycheck on a monthly basis, and he was pretty excited about it. So, you know, just we need to be competitive, and if I want business to be in the state, you know, those are the things that we need to do. And to be quite honest, that's what my colleagues are doing, and so I'm very competitive by nature. Right? You might get that sense by the time we're done, but...
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned maybe reducing the individual income tax all the way down to a 0% rate, abolishing it, which at first sort of blush seems a little radical. But as you know, there's nine U.S. states that don't have individual income taxes. And the interesting thing about them is they're in all different parts of the country. There's red states, there's blue states, you know, Washington State and Tennessee, Nevada, New Hampshire, Florida. And they all managed to survive, and indeed all the states that have no income taxes are prospering and generally have high economic growth rates. And so it's really not as radical as it initially.
No, it's not. And we did we're in town today with this week with the Republican governors across the country, and 15 of our Republican governors has additional tax cuts on their agenda this year. So as I've indicated, that number is going to continue to grow. And if we're going to continue to be competitive, then we have to be aggressive. But again, that means growing revenue, looking at other issues that will help bring business and industry to the state of Iowa, but then keeping spending in check, and that's key. The budget that I just proposed to the legislature this year only spends, I think it's like 82% of what my projected revenue is. So, you know, those are the things that you have to do.
I was looking at a map the other day. Iowa's got six neighbors. On the one side, you've got South Dakota, a no-income tax state, very competitive. If you look at the data, they've got strong in-migration. Then on the other side, you've got Illinois, probably the worst fiscally run state in the nation. The difference between Iowa and Illinois in terms of basic fiscal metrics is kind of amazing. Iowa's got AAA bond rating, low debt, low pension, low unfunded pension. Illinois has got a very low credit rating, high debt, high unfunded pension. What accounts for the difference? Is it sort of, is it just that different fiscal cultures have grown up over time, or what do you attribute?
I think it's just a philosophy too. I mean, we're a right to work state. I don't know if you said that. Also, they're not. So a lot of differences. I was just meeting with a potential investor in the state of Iowa this week. We're hoping to land them. I think Illinois is my competition. And honestly, after walking through all of the differences that you just laid out, the last thing I said is I'm fairly certain that we'll be able to honor the incentive package that we put together, and I'm not sure Illinois can even honor the pension program for the teachers and the state employees that are currently working in that state. So, you know, they might be able to offer the moon. Whether they'll be able to actually deliver is something that you need to consider. So, you know, I just, it's kind of who we are as a state, I think. I don't know. You know, they just have philosophical difference. It really is. I think Iowans know better what to do with their money than government, and we continue to see growth in government over there, and they believe that they have all the answers, and we don't. And when you really, you know, let Iowans decide what they're going to do with their money, we see communities flourish, we see the state flourish, we see revenues grow. So it works.
You touched on the state budget, and this is where you scored very well on the governor's report card, partly because you kept spending really in check. It's actually kind of amazing. Governor Reynolds came into office in 2017. The first 5 years in office, she held the state budget to a 2% annual growth. The average state was 6%. We're in the middle of fiscal 23 now. I think the Iowa budget's growing about 1%. The average for the 50 states is 6%. So what's your secret? How were you able to do that? Legislatures usually want to spend more money.
I know. That's the problem, right? We do work very closely with our legislature. We do have both chambers are controlled by the Republicans. And, you know, we meet every year. So it's communicating, working together, setting expectations. But we know collectively we all want to continue to reduce taxes. And the only way that you can do that is keep spending in check. But not only have I been able to cut taxes, but as you heard, I mean, we've made historic investments in key priorities to Iowans. Education, since fiscal year 12 through 22, we've increased funding in K-12 education by over $1 billion. So, you know, we've continued to increase in priorities, but we've still been able to continue to look for ways to reduce the budget as well. So we've been able to do both. I think last year was under 1%, the fiscal year that we're in right now, growth. This year, revenue has increased, but again, I think it's about a 3% increase, so still fairly modest. But the largest percentage of that increase is because of school choice. We actually were able to fund putting the ESA in place, and so that's probably contributed to a little bit of a larger increase in funding this year.
Maybe with that, we should jump over to the school choice issues. And Neil, if you want to take it away.
Sure. Well, you've already kind of hit at some of the fiscal stuff I was going to ask, but that's not really the most interesting part. You mentioned that you're very competitive. And so I have one question, which is, by some counts, Iowa is the third state with universal school choice. I don't actually count West Virginia because they're not quite there. Arizona was number
one. We don't either, just to make that clear.
I mean, I don't want to seem anti-Mountaineer or something. But,
I know. I'm
based
kidding.
On data.
Yeah.
But I'm sort of curious, how, one, did you let Arizona beat you to getting universal school choice? And then much more interesting is you've been working on it for a few years. What do you think sort of put you over the top this year?
Well, I want to give just a huge shout out to both Arizona and West Virginia because, you know, it just to lead and to take a stance. And Doug had been working on this for a long time. So, but again, as you'll notice, the governors are competitive. So I tell Doug, well, it took you 8 years to get to where you're at. We're doing it in three. So, but you're about to see this happen across the country. So it's just not Iowa. You're going to see additional governors. I think kind of that'll set the bar, and that's kind of where they'll be looking to go to implement it as quickly as they can. COVID was just a real pivotal point, not only for parents, I think, but for governors across the country. I see, the data that we see right now really demonstrates that it was the wrong thing to do to keep the kids out of the classroom, and the amount of loss, is just staggering, and some of those kids will never get that back. We were one of the first states to get our kids back in the classroom. I'm really proud of that. We did it safely and responsibly, but we just could see that that is where they needed to be and how important it was. And so we've been able to minimize our learning loss. But to talk to parents and to students and to have, schools actually sue me to keep the kids out of the classroom, and it was one of our largest school districts, and had a tremendous impact on kids dropping out of school. So many of them were, I think it was 90-some percent of the kids were in free and reduced lunch that had dropped out. A lot of my minorities were impacted by that. And it just really hit a fine point with me because the parents that were in that school that had sued to stay closed, that had the financial resources, were able to put their child someplace else so they weren't impacted by not being in the classroom, not having a safe environment to learn, not having a hot meal, which a lot of the kids didn't. And, I just fundamentally disagree that option for parents to decide what is the best environment for their child to learn and be the best that they can be can only be afforded to families that have the financial means to do that. Every parent, regardless of income or zip code, should have that option. To put their child, whether it's faith-based, whether it's, a safer school because they're being bullied, maybe it's a gang-related, whatever that reason may be, it shouldn't be decided by, it shouldn't be only available to individuals that have the resources to do it. And so we've been working on it for three years, but I think, and then to be honest, just one other point, I think COVID gave parents just a front row seat to some of the things that was happening in the classroom, and they really didn't like what they saw. Honestly, they just want a quality education for their kids in the core subjects. They want to continue to be the parents at home and just, again, help prepare the kids for a successful future. And so we had more and more parents just reach out and ask, for the opportunity to make that choice.
A very common objection to school choice, and we've heard it for the ESAs, is, well, there's no accountability. The money will just go out there and it'll be wasted. What's your answer? Is there accountability in this?
There is accountability in this because it's only accredited private schools, and so they go through a very similar accreditation process that our public schools do. And if you go to our Department of Education website, you will see a very comprehensive list of the accreditation requirements that they're held to. We did add some language into the bill, too, to ask for some additional requirements. We wanted to be respective also of the private school system. But we, you know, I wanted to know what some of the outcomes were. We're investing in ESAs and giving parents choice, so we're funding the student and not the system. But I want to know some of those metrics. We can aggregate the data, but I want to know how they're scoring, what they're doing, how they're doing. And we've got just a small set of additional metrics that we've added to that. But it's just not true. They're held to many of the same standards that the public schools are. And in fact, honestly, if you'll go look, it's a very extensive list.
Yeah, and of course there's accountability by having to attract parents to your school, which it's almost never mentioned when people say there's no accountability in
that. Well, because really, that's what they would, they say, really, if they don't like my school, they're paying to come here. And if they don't like what they're doing, they're going to leave. So, the accountability is with the parents. Thank you for helping me remember that.
Well, I only have like 3 talking points I always use, so I remember that one. I'm curious, though, also because Iowa is a relatively rural state, and a very common objection is this doesn't help rural families. Well, does it help rural families?
Yeah, so Iowa is very rural. I went to a public school system. We educated our daughters in a public school system, a rural public school system. My daughter is a public school teacher in a rural public school. So you can imagine she was at the condition of the state. You know, bless her heart. I said, this might be one of those times it might not be very fun to have your mom be the governor of the state of Iowa talking about school choice. But I truly believe with all my heart it elevates education overall, and she's not afraid of it. She's a great teacher. I'm very proud of her. But so I had rural lawmakers in my own party that were kind of, I couldn't get them on board. And so I offered to go to their district to do town halls, whatever, and talk to the superintendents and just walk through some of the reality of what it meant, and to try to answer some of the misconceptions that were out there. And so I sat down with a lot of superintendents and principals, and I said, I know I'm not here to convince you. I know you're not going to be convinced, but I believe it's the right thing to do. Here's why. But tell me, what are we doing that impacts your ability to really provide your students and be competitive in these rural school districts? And what I heard over and over and over is that there are just too many restrictions, too many, everything was a shall, like everything in government, which I forgot to talk about my realignment, so I want to get back there and talk about that before we get done. We add, and we never take away. It's referred to Chapter 12. I heard it over and over. Citizens don't know, but I can tell you, teachers know about Chapter 12, principals know about Chapter 12, and superintendents. And I read the entire chapter, and it was a nightmare. It was outdated. It was so restrictive and almost punitive. And so I said, well, I promise we'll look at that, and we'll change a lot of those shalls to May and give you more flexibility. The other thing is, our average teacher salary in Iowa is about $59,000, but that's probably more reflected in our larger school districts, not so much in our rural school districts. And they just didn't feel like they could be competitive. And so we tried to look at existing funding in some of our categoricals, and we freed up some of the restrictions on that to allow them to only put that into teacher salaries, not administration, but only into bringing on new teachers or increasing, that amazing individual that's in the classroom every day working with our kids to be able to pay them what they're worth. We have occupational sharing, and we extended that where small school districts can share a principal or whatever. There's about 20 different categories that they can share. We extended that. That was a big thing for them. So I made it, I think it was at least an offer to them to show them that I hear you, you're right, and we're going to give you some flexibility and some opportunity to be more competitive with your teachers. And that in the primary helped bring some of my rural lawmakers on board.
Interestingly, Utah, not long after you passed your bill, passed a similar bill, also delivering more funding for teachers. And I think it's important to understand, people often frame school choice as this is anti-teacher. And it's school choice in no way inherently is anti-teacher anyway, but this sort of putting it together with helping teachers, I think, is a smart way to go. But, Chris, I think the governor teed up a question for you on realignment, well, so I'm going to put this down.
I wanted to just say real quick, having part of that discussion and really working with the superintendent, since it's passed, I've already, again, met with several. And so they've said things like, you know, I realize, like, if I'm not at the table, I'm on the table. We were a little bit, you know, focused on not letting you get ESA through. But now we like what you've started to do with Chapter 12. Can we come back and continue to work on it? We will. We're really involved in registered apprenticeship programs in Iowa. I'm so excited about what we've done with those. Look at our first, we're the first state in the country to do a teacher's registered apprenticeship program that will bring 1,000 into the pipeline over the next 2 years. 500 paraeducators and 500 teachers that we're growing within. That's really helping to diversify our teaching population. It's awesome. So we want to be able to kind of align some credit with the registered apprenticeship programs that we have. And then I had another superintendent say, well, I don't like what you did. I didn't agree with the law, but it's the law. And so I can tell you what, I'm going to make my public school the best, the destination of choice. And that's the kind of culture that we want to drive. And so it's already happening. So it's going to be fun, I think, to see that. Thanks.
Governor Reynolds, as I understand it, has sort of teed up two sort of reform of government strategies this year. One is on the regulatory front. She's called for an overhaul of Iowa state regulations. And she's also called for a restructuring of Iowa government to reduce the number of agencies, the number of bureaucracies, to sell excess state land that the state government doesn't need. And perhaps you can discuss each of those initiatives a bit.
And truly, that's one of the ways we're going to continue to keep costs down so that we can continue to keep that growth at a minimum and then continue to invest in priorities that are important to Iowans. So we've spent the last 6 months really doing a deep dive into the executive branch, the agencies that are underneath me. We brought in a consultant to help us do that because we just don't, I have a very small team. I have an amazing rock star team. We've been able to get a lot done over the last several years because of them. But so you can't just tinker around the edges and hope to see results. So we brought a consultant in. We worked with all of the agencies. We hadn't done it for 40 years. And boy, after what we've uncovered as we've lifted the hood, I can't even imagine what is happening at the federal level. We are a small state. Not been done in 40 years. Come to find out, I knew this, but 37 executive branch agencies that were part of my cabinet. 37. It was out of line with other states that were similar in size and population. Arizona, Arkansas, Mississippi, Oklahoma all have same size population, same size budget. Had about 15 agencies that were under the executive branch. I think the real kicker for me, too, you talked about Illinois. As we did the review, we found out that we were appropriating $2,000 per capita more than Illinois. That is four times our population. That's not good. And so we are going from 37 state agencies down to 16. Really excited about it. I think it's about a $214 million savings over 4 years. And I think that's probably conservative, to be quite honest, as we continue to realign the services that we're providing Iowans. We did kind of, and I'm taking it through the legislature, so we'll have, you know, full transparency. Iowans can weigh in. But we did kind of a proof of concept. So I did our Department of Public Health and Human Services. We actually, through an MOU, combined them, two really, really large agencies. Nobody lost their job, and none of the services were downgraded. And it is incredible, I think, the HHS, the department that we've put together. You know, these are individuals that are struggling to get through a day and had to go through seven or eight different doors just to get an answer. I mean, how inefficient is that? And there's a cost to that. And then there's just no synergies and collaboration. It was very duplicative. There's a cost to that. So we did that. And then another great example that we've been able to share with the legislature is with Department of Inspections and Appeals and Workforce Development. They're administrative law judges. Workforce, they were behind about 5,400 cases. We were able to merge the two, again, provide some efficiencies, and they eliminated that backlog in 3 months. And so I had some really good examples to share with the legislature, and the agencies that we've brought together have together sat down with the committees and with Iowans and talked about why they agree with what we're doing and the direction that we're moving the state. So I actually won't be able to, I won't have to go off-site to have a cabinet meeting. I can actually have a cabinet meeting in my office, and we can really, I think, just really talk about strategizing and better initiatives and just better service to our citizens, and we save money in the out.
It sounds like you're taking like a very data-driven approach to this, and it seems from what you've already said, there's sort of two, you know, the advantage of federalism, of course, is that the 50 states not only compete with each other, they can learn from each other, and it seems like there's two ways you can sort of learn from other states. You can look at the data and look at how other states structure their government, but then also you have personal relationships with governors like Doug Ducey who are leading with a lot of reforms, and so it seems like there's those two ways you can learn about sort of best practices in other states.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when we did occupational license reform, we looked at what Doug had done in Arizona, and he really led on that too, and we came right in behind it. So you look at your existing state and what you're dealing with, look at what some of the other states are, look at the metrics and the data, and then you put your own plan together. The other thing I'm hoping, we have 99 counties in Iowa, and we just have too much government. And if we want to continue to cut taxes, we need to look at that overall. And I didn't feel that I could go challenge 99 counties and local government to get their act together if I didn't take a look at my, you know, get my own house together first. So I'm hoping I can be a real example for some of our local governments in our 99 counties across the state of Iowa. We need to do that differently too.
Let me just ask one more government workforce question, and maybe we can jump back to Neil. So we talked briefly before we came on about collective bargaining reform in Iowa government, which I hadn't learned about until yesterday when I was reading up. So in 2017, I think just before the governor came into office, the state did really a profound reform of the labor union regulations for government employees, and they seem really important, and that seems like a good model for other states to follow.
It's been a really good model, and we've really seen our agencies and our employees, you know, they are the face of state government, and actually the environment is so much better, and they're able to advance based on merit, and we've just in various agencies across the state have had such great outcomes because of that. But I said, you know, it's not often that you get an opportunity to take on a state monopoly and to be able to overhaul collective bargaining reform, and then to be able to bring in school choice as well with from that perspective. I think we've taken on two pretty big state monopolies, and I think, you know, we'll be able to show that those were absolutely the right decisions to do, but we've been able to show that, I think, with collective bargaining reform. So good outcomes.
And there's two sorts of labor reforms that states will often do. There's right to work, which is sort of the rules on fundraising for private sector unions. But then there's collective bargaining within the government, which state legislatures and governors have control over.
And what they can negotiate, and that was part of the process. And so we've limited it to what they can negotiate is just salaries, and then we've capped that at 3%. Now, they can agree to bring in other negotiable items, but both parties have to agree before it comes to the table. Law enforcement was the only exception to that. We did not include them in the collective bargaining reform, but it's contrary to what the naysayer said, state government still exists, and we're still able to continue to provide tremendous services to Iowans, and we've been able to do it in a effective manner.
Yeah, this whole discussion actually makes me very happy about federalism and that we have it, and that you can learn from other states, and where they do something wrong, you don't have to do it. When you do something right, you can look at what others have done. And you mentioned occupational licensing, and that led me to a question that is sort of tied in with that. And Cato's got a new series of papers, which are a book about new American workers. And one of the things we talk about is college degree requirements to get especially jobs in government, but also licensure that would require it for maybe not good reasons, not actually seeing that degree means you can do something. Is that something that you're working on?
I think we did address that in part of it because we had to look inside and see what some of our requirements were, and college degree was a big part of that requirement. And so I think if we haven't, we will. I'm looking at Taryn. We've done so much in the last couple of years, and then we've got another proposal that we're working on right now, red tape, where we put a moratorium on any new rules or regulations, and then we're having each agency review every rule that they have in their department, and if it meets the new standard, it can be renewed. Otherwise, it's not going to be renewed. So we're going through that process as well. But that was preventing so many people from getting into the workforce, and we were encouraging other private sector to do that. And then we took a look at what we were doing, and it was like, oh my gosh, we're putting those same restrictions in place, and we need to not do that. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, okay. I was only thinking of that because Maryland, actually a little while ago, removed a bunch of college requirements.
Yep.
And Pennsylvania's new governor was just talking about it. It seems like it's kind of picking up steam. And
yep.
I know you guys lead on a lot of good stuff.
I think we've done that already. I know it's been part of the, we have. I'm getting the from my chief of staff. Thank gosh for the chief of staff over there. Yeah. I knew we had talked about it, but I said, I think it was kind of folded into some of that original round of workforce issues that we've been dealing with. But we do a lot with work-based learning, STEM. I've been involved in STEM education since I've been a lieutenant governor. But again, it works, and especially for keeping our young people in rural Iowa because it connects them with the opportunities. They find out what they have a passion for, and sometimes it doesn't require a four-year degree. Sometimes it does, but a lot of times if they start with the business and they want to continue to advance in their career, no debt, making a living, and then if they want to advance, a lot of times the business will pay for them to go ahead and get a four-year degree. So it really is a smart thing to do. Not for all, but at least it's an option, and it should be.
I don't know when we're going to audience questions, but I have another, unless you're ready. Okay, so this gets a little bit philosophical into one of my favorite questions, but as Gene mentioned, I'm sort of interested in educational freedom as a way to diffuse cultural and social conflicts. Obviously, this has been very big across the country. We keep something called the public schooling battle map, which I always like to sell. But there are several school districts in Iowa, just as in everywhere, that have had conflicts recently about books in the library and things like that. Was some of the thinking behind the school choice push to enable people to choose what they think is the right values for their kids, in part so they don't have to sort of fight with their neighbors?
Well, we've done both. We said no to critical race theory. We've said we're doing a parental rights bill that's working its way through the legislature right now that says actually parents are the decision makers for their children. I think it's so sad that we have to codify that in today's environment, but the fact of the matter is we have to. We've had school districts, school boards that have said a seventh grader can decide if he shares information with the parent about pronouns or changes in names or whatever that may be, just completely taking the parent out of the child's education. You can pass the various legislative bills to address some of that, but ultimately, sometimes they find a way around it, or it's just really hard to completely stop that. But by giving parents, all parents, the choice to decide what environment they want their child to receive their education, that is going to be the most effective. Because if nothing else, and I don't mean this in a negative way, sort of, but they understand money. We're per pupil funding for the schools. And if you start to have the one school where they took the parents out of their child's education, they've had, and it's a larger school, but I think between 200 and 300 have already made the decision. Parents have made the decision to leave that school district and go to another. We had open enrollment before we passed the Students First Act. So that already, if you think about, we've sort of had it for quite some time. But this allows the funding to go with it for the parent, or adds private. But I think ultimately that will be the most impactful to drive different decisions and maybe get people back to, or get schools back to the what parents expect, and that's just a quality education in core subjects, and just kind of leave the rest to the home.
I'm going to turn to audience questions now, both in person and online. The online audience can submit questions directly on the event webpage, Facebook, YouTube, and on Twitter using hashtag GovReportCard. Please, in this room, speak clearly and directly into the microphone so everyone in the auditorium and online can hear the question. Announce your name and affiliation if you think that's important. And a couple other ground rules. Please do keep the focus on what we've been talking about today, fiscal, education, regulatory policy in the states, not Chinese spy balloons or Hunter Biden's laptop or whatever else you might be interested in that we're not talking about today. And finally, please do make sure that you get pretty quickly in your question to something that ends with a question mark and no DC soliloquies, please. So with that, do we have any questions? And raise your hand, and Chris will bring the microphone to you.
Perfect. So we'll start with a question from our online audience. Alan asks to the governor, keeping average spending down while expanding on initiatives that are important to Iowans must require cutting programs and spending. And you talked a little bit about this, what you'd looked at in your state administration. What have you been able to cut, or what lessons do you have for other states that you want to share?
Well, we didn't cut. That was the point I was trying to make. We actually made historic investments in K-12 education. We've added new money to education every single year. I've invested in public safety. We've invested in broadband. We invested over $100 million in broadband. We're a rural state. And if we want to be successful and see prosperity in every single corner of our state, we need to be able to connect. It's the expectation of young people. They're not going to live there if they can't connect. So it doesn't mean that. It means being more efficient and effective in the way that you deliver the services. It means growing revenue by letting Iowans and businesses be successful and grow. We had over 35,000, I think, new startups, small business startups last year. We set another record in the state of Iowa. Even in some very difficult times, we continue to see growth in the state of Iowa. So that's encouraging. Again, it's not either or. I believe that you can do both. I believe we have a record of doing both, but you just have to be targeted in how you allocate the funds, and then hopefully continue to see growth in your state. And we believe you see that growth by reducing taxes. We think that's part of the scenario. I think in 2021 we had a 11% growth. 2022 we had 11% growth. This year we're looking, they had projected about a negative 1.9, but we're running to date in revenue growth, but we are actually running at about 5% right now through January. So we're ahead of projections at this point.
I mean, the key thing in recent years for a lot of states has just been that the I think it took all analysts by surprise that starting in sort of summer 2020, state revenues initially dropped, but then they boomed across many states, which took a lot of people by surprise. So a lot of states, they spent a lot of extra money. They sort of gave one-time kind of tax breaks. But then I think the sensible and smart states took the surpluses and they did essentially long-term investment, which was making their tax structure more competitive to draw businesses and yep. and households to the state to benefit the state in the long term.
Yep. In the center there.
Yeah, Governor, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. So my name is Josh Fertelman. I'm with the Mercatus Center. So we do a lot of study on regulatory growth. Really excited about the regulatory moratorium. I'm curious, with that moratorium, I guess two-part question with that. One, are you interested in some kind of target for reduction in regulations? Do you have a specific number in mind? And then two, I'm just curious, are there any particular regulations that are high on the target list, things you've heard from business groups that you really want to reduce?
And we've already done some. Thank you for the question. First of all, I appreciate that. So we again brought in a company to help monitor that so that I can actually have data. So they've been able to account for all of the regulations that we have on the books right now, what that number looks like, the number of words we're talking at a level that doesn't even make sense. We have so many regulations that shouldn't even be on the books. They're outdated or really barriers to economic growth in the state of Iowa. So we'll be able to benchmark this as we move along. We're just starting the process, but I think it was important to bring in the consultant to help us do that. We're doing four agencies at a time, so I think we're spreading it out over 4 years so we can really be focused on each individual agency. And we'll just continue, you know, we don't want to be a barrier to economic growth. We have to do things reasonably. We have to make sure that we're providing safety, but we also want to make sure that we're a partner with business and industry and growth in the state of Iowa. So I'm looking forward to it. I think we've laid out a pretty strategic and well thought out plan. I just got a quick update, I think last week, from my policy team that's running it. And so they're ready to go, and we'll keep you updated as we move through, because I think you also score on some things too. So yeah. So I'll be interested to see we're not where we should be. I mean, we are way out of whack again, and you just tend to add and you never do the hard work to take away. And then there's a process if there are some new regulations that absolutely need to put in place. We've got a process for them to be able to do that, but we've tried to keep that fairly narrow as well.
Yes, ma'am. In the front.
Yeah, the mic's coming there.
My name is Joe Freeman. I write about women in politics and take photographs of women in politics. Iowa has been the home of some great women, starting with Carrie Chapman Catt. What are you doing to enhance women's opportunities at this time?
Oh, thank you for that question. First of all, just being the first female to lead the state of Iowa as a governor, I don't think I really even fully understood what the impact of that would be, but I can't tell you how many little girls recognize me and just want their picture taken or just want to come up and say hi. I'm trying to lead by example, and it's not because they were a woman, but it's because they deserved it. Almost my entire leadership team are women, and again, it's because they earned it, not because I was filling a slot, but that also really sends a message. We come out to RGA and we get out of the car and walk in, and I've got four really strong women that are surrounding me, and I have had people stop and just comment on the fact that they just don't see that very often. So that's encouraging. The other thing I do is when I'm in my office, I've got like I thought I might have made a wrong choice, but you know, the typical black big wingback chair. I thought, I'm going red. You know, I'm a girl. I'm going to do something different. But anyway, when I have young girls in the office, I always try to have them sit in the chair behind my desk and just really let them know that they can be anything they want to be. And if that's a mom or a teacher, or if they want to be a president or a governor of the state, they can do that. So hopefully I'm leading by example, and I've surrounded myself with very strong, articulate, capable, hard-charging, compassionate women. And it's been fun to just see the reaction that we get from women, not only in the state of Iowa, but across the country when we travel and participate in other events. It's important.
Chris?
Coming from our online audience, Donna asks, how will Iowa protect the parents in private schools that participate and use ESA funds from regulation by the state that effectively turns them back into single management public schools?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in the bill, we have some autonomy language. And if you look at the other states, Arizona did this. So again, we were able to look at Florida and Arizona and see the language that they used in their school choice bill. It's been tested through the court. So that's always good too, because you want to put together a bill that's in the best place that it can be to succeed. You don't want to be caught up in litigation for years to come. And so we do have some autonomy language that's in there. They were fine with that. That was also a concern of a lot of our legislators too. So we worked very closely with our private schools too to make sure that they were comfortable with that. And I think we really did a good job of striking a balance with the language that we included in the bill.
So when you talk about you have to make sure the statute won't be challenged in court. Are you talking about federal regs, or are you talking about state regs, or both?
Just state. I mean, ESAs are fine. We'll make it through. But you just have to. I have a spreadsheet of lawsuits. You know, it's just a litigious society that we live in. And so it's a way to slow things down sometimes, too, especially if you don't agree with the bill. So we just, you really have to really try hard. You know, we really work hard to make sure that we have legislation in the best possible position to be successful. And I got a great team that does that, but that's always something we're thinking about. And if you have other states that have put together legislation and it's gone through the process, which sometimes happens, too, that's also helpful because there's case law there.
It's very rare to see a school choice bill passed and not then challenged quickly in court, in part because unions are very powerful in most places and are very quick to say we're going to strike it down, because once families actually get to use it, it's much harder to take away because they want that kind of power.
They want the choice. Mm-hmm. I think that's the other thing, too, why one of the biggest outcomes I think of the bill will be is there's just a lot of fear-mongering out there, and there's just a lot of information that's not true. And I truly believe, because there's no data to support it, but yet we'll be another state that will be able to dispel a lot of the myths and the fear-mongering that you hear surrounding educational choice.
Hi, my name is McCluskey. I always stutter on that. I was for 19 years at the University of Iowa on the faculty in economics and history. Go Hawks.
I'm a Cyclone girl, but I love the Hawks too, unless they're playing each other.
I'm extremely impressed by what you've been able to do. It reminds me of the great Canadian feminist, the first mayor of female mayor of Ottawa, Canada, who said, in order to get half the credit, a woman has to do twice as well. Fortunately, this is not difficult. But I have got...
Hey, Brian, there we go. There's a...
I have got a question about administrative bloat in the universities. It's the main complaint that faculty members all over the United States have, that the number of administrators gets larger and larger. And I was intrigued by your point that in your K through 12 subsidies, giving more money, you specify that it can't go to administration. Have any plans to do the same thing with the three big state-funded universities?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I had one of the school districts that the superintendent's over 2,000 employees, and half is administration. Half. You know, my goodness. And then we wonder why we can't pay teachers what we should be paying them that are in the classroom every single day doing the hard work. And they have a purpose, so I don't mean that. But that's ridiculous. You know, that's ridiculous. So we were really excited when we were able to find a mechanism that we could use ongoing funds, because it's funds that's in the base, so it rolls every year when we apply the state supplemental aid or whatever the increase is for education funding. It continues to grow because it's a part of that. So for them, we had four categoricals: teacher leadership. There were three different ones. So we allowed them to take the unused portion or all of it and roll it into teacher salaries. But we specifically said in the bill it can only be used for teacher salaries, not for administrative positions at all. So I think that might be a model that we can use other places. Yeah.
One final question from online.
Alex asks, the governor gets the pleasure of working with a Republican legislature, both in the House and the Senate, but it took you several years to get universal choice adopted. Can you walk us through some of the difficulties you ran into in the Republican caucus of educating your fellow Republicans on the values of school choice?
Yeah. So for 2 years in a row, I started out just failing schools. I got it through the Senate, couldn't get it through the House. Came back, and we Republicans control both chambers. Came back the second year. We expanded it a little bit. We set a cap at $3,000, $5,000, but we tied it to income, so it was, you know, 300% of federal poverty, and some additional, you know, a lot of the similar other language that's similar in this bill. Passed the Senate again, only to be held up in the House by like two or three votes. And one of the individuals that was not helping it was the chair of the education committee. So I couldn't get them to take it to the floor for a vote, because you make different decisions when you actually have to push yes or no. But if you're never forced to make that decision, you can say a lot of different, you can take a lot of different positions. And I served in the state Senate, so I can be hard on them because I was one of them. So, you know, I was one of those legislators at one point. So I had to make a very difficult decision, and it's not one that I took lightly, but I was either going to stand by and continue to be an enabler and not get this legislation passed, or I was going to weigh in on some of the primaries with my own party. And so I would go out to legislators that were running, especially in areas where there was a primary, and the chair of the education committee was one of those areas. I asked his opponent if she was in favor of school choice. It was one of her number one priorities. And so I weighed in on 9 primary races. I was able to, we flipped 8 of them. So it was successful. I got the numbers. We got the numbers that we needed. And the 9th one, it was really, he just couldn't answer it. And so I just couldn't lend my endorsements only go so far. The issue won overwhelmingly. And that's what I kept telling them. This is what parents want. This is what parents want. I hear it as I travel all across the state. And the individual that we didn't win, he met me the next day. I did an event down in his area, and he said, "I'm all Team Reynolds. We're ready to go." And really, once we walked through the bill with him, he voted for it. So was for it. So again, not a decision that I made lightly, but it was the right thing to do, and we were able to. It went to a vote, and we were able to be successful in getting it across the finish line this year.
All right. Thank you, Governor, Chris, Neil, and all of you for a great conversation. Please join us outside in the foyer for lunch.
Thanks a lot, Governor Reynolds.
Thanks.